This is the Faith in a Fresh Vibe podcast. I am your host, Ro Hattie. Welcome to the bonus episode on Gaza and the ongoing genocide that is happening in Palestine. Recording on Treaty 7 territory in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is a bonus episode, the tail end of Farewell Evangelicalism, a serial season interrogating the malformed pillars in conservative Christianity. You can find all 12 episodes now available. In this episode, we take a recording from a recent A Beautiful Table Sunday service that featured my friend, Dr. Sarah Lalonde, who recently spent a month at the Gaza European Hospital. This bonus episode has two components. The first will be my voice offering some context, a little bit of historical context, and then bringing us all the way into the present. And then the interview with Dr. Sarah Lalonde will be in the second half. So you can jump forward if you wish to listen to Sarah's story. It's critical in this moment that we name the ongoing genocide happening in Gaza. Calling for justice and making our voices heard. That includes tangible actions such as calling, emailing your representatives, regardless of which country you are in, but in particular, those of you who are Americans, to continue to mobilize yourselves to call for an end to the arms sales to Israel and funding to Israel. Your voice counts. And we encourage you to find scripts if you need them to contact your local representatives. This episode comes with a content warning because Dr. Sarah worked in the ER at the European Gaza Hospital. She will be sharing difficult stories, particularly ones about children that she treated. Pay attention to your body, what it is holding. Give yourself some pause if you need it. Let's begin. It's crucial in this moment for all of us, and although the context for this interview was towards Canadians, we are all not mere observers. In fact, we can be participants. This past February 2025, before the federal election in Canada, government approval for permits to sell upwards of $40 million in arms sales to Israel were approved. Therefore, as a country, we are complicit in the funding that is ongoing, fueling this genocide. It's also difficult in the realm of social media and on the web. We are bombarded with relentless propaganda. It makes it difficult to sift through what is true, what is misinformation. In many ways, we are against $1 billion worth of mis and disinformation crafted to shape particular narratives. Discerning can be hard. That's why we've invited Dr. Lalonde to come and offer a first-person account of her recent time in Gaza. Now, there is also theological and colonial context for us to consider. And if you consider yourself as a Christian, I think specifically about those who grew up in evangelical or fundamentalist traditions, we need to examine how our theological formation shapes our understanding of geopolitics. Many Christians have been taught eschatology, which is a fancy word for the end times framework, that are deeply influenced with how we perceive events that are happening in Israel. Curiously, religious formation in the West, especially in the United States, Canada, and the UK, shapes foreign policy. With this in mind, maybe we actually have a larger voice than we think. And as a nation and as people of faith, that influence is much larger than we care to imagine, even if it's not our land. Some Christians, in fact, believe they have a divine stake in the future of Israel, because they tie their theological hopes with the return of Jesus, and somehow that also connects to the current political realities happening in the modern state of Israel. This belief is dangerous. It's dangerous because it justifies political opinions that are on distorted interpretations of Scripture, And what it produces is abject violence, which is odd. If you claim to be a Jesus follower, Jesus being the proponent for nonviolence, that you would actively seek out the annihilation of certain people based on their beliefs, their religion, or skin color, simply because you think that's what God wants. It's sad that there are forms of Christianity right now that directly contribute to the political support of violence, violence that has enabled the ongoing genocide. Therefore, it's not theoretical. It's happening now. Malformed theology kills. Let's take a brief moment to give an overview of what is happening in what is called the Middle East, which is a colonial term, but specifically in Gaza, Israel, and broader Palestine. A site, a region, a country, a space of people that have sat in tension for thousands of years, in part because of its religious significance. Today, Jerusalem is considered holy by three major world religions, and as a result, the land has been repeatedly colonized over millennia. In the New Testament, we read about Jesus living under empire, under colonial rule, and at the time that was Roman occupation. But that was just one phase. The land has been taken over again and again by outside imperial forces. The people indigenous to the land, who have lived there for generations, have continually faced assimilation and displacement. So fast forward to modern times. The state of Israel, as we know it, is a relatively recent creation, one that came about post-World War II. Before that, there was no modern state of Israel, as we call it, nor was there a Palestine. But we do know that the people existed, that Palestinians existed, and just because the people exist means that Palestinians in Palestine exist. Jewish folks also existed in the Palestine region. So we don't need modern nation states to affirm the existence and identity of people. For centuries before the state of Israel was created, Palestinians were the majority in the region, while Jewish people still live there. The balance begins to shift dramatically following waves of migration following the violence of the greatest genocide on record, the Holocaust. But let's take a step back. Before World War II, in 1917, prior to World War II, the Balfour Declaration, issued by the British Empire, proposed the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. This is where religion intersects with colonialism. It was, curiously, Zionist Christians, largely in the West, in Britain, who spearheaded support for the idea. And here's something that might be surprising. Christians can be Zionists, and so can Jews. Both have similar goals, the claim to the land, but they have very different endpoints. Most Christians believe in Jesus as the Messiah, which is not remotely a belief in Judaism. So Christian Zionism often supports Israel, not because of a love for their Jewish neighbors, but because they believe it will hasten the return of Jesus. You can imagine this is deeply problematic because it's disconnected from both justice and reality. Western Christianity, particularly in its colonial form, has adopted this mindset that justifies domination. Domination of land, people, and culture. So you begin to see how in the modern realities, what's happening right now in the genocide in Gaza, how those colonial attributes, they apply regardless of religion. We also see this echoed in Canada's own history, our colonial history with Indigenous peoples. And it's reflected again in how many Western Christians view Israel and Palestine. Following the Holocaust, the United Nations drew new borders and established the State of Israel. In doing so, they displaced Palestinians who had lived there for generations. The wheels were already in motion prior to the establishment of the new Israeli state, but became an acute problem when displaced Palestinians who had lived in the land for generations and millennia were forcibly removed. Often ignored in Western conversations, especially among evangelicals, which is ironic, Palestinians are solely associated with Islam. Yet, when we think about the indigenous Christians of the region, those are Palestinian Christians. This erasure enables a certain level of violence. Today, the primary imperial forces supporting the nation of Israel and their ongoing violence is no longer Britain, although all Western countries play a role, but it's the United States. Western media is shaped by colonial mindset and has often portrayed Palestinians, especially the brown Muslim type, as violent or inferior. All the racist ideas we care to ignore. This erasure contributes to dehumanization, making it easier to ignore or justify the scale of the devastation. And yes, there are extremes on both sides. On October 7th, just under 2 years ago, 1,200 Israelis were murdered. This violent and extremist action has been met with a disproportionate extremist action. Now, we can't make comment on what is happening specifically in Israel surrounding the current government regime and the atrocities that it is committing. What we can name is that the rhetoric is the same on the extremes. Both say, from sea to sea, blank will be free, both calling for the literal annihilation of the other. What we need is somewhere in between to find the pathway to peace. Instead, we have genocide. Estimates pit 50,000 Palestinians, almost half children, have been killed since this genocide began, and it is a staggering number that should stop us in our tracks. With that, we linger now towards the conversation with Dr. Sarah Lalonde. Dr. Lalonde is from La Belle Province, Quebec. She is based in Montreal and specializes in community and rural medicine. That has taken her to many remote regions in Canada, serving Indigenous communities across these lands. She has also gained international experience working in Guinea, as well as Albania, working with Afghan refugees, Togo, and Chad. Dr. Lalonde is also a provincial physician in the province of Quebec and, as well, a volunteer doing work in human trafficking. Her most recent post this past winter was when she spent 1 month in Gaza serving in the emergency department at the European Gaza Hospital. And that's where our conversation begins.
Yeah, that was a great intro. It got me thinking about, so last year I had the honor of going to this conference called Christ at the Checkpoint, which is by Palestinian theologians who are living, the conference is held in Bethlehem. And the conference was to see how they could respond to how Jesus would behave in their situation of oppression. So I got to hear a lot of those voices, and I was re-listening to one of their talks today as I was driving to my own church. And that got me thinking about some of the concepts they presented, which you kind of touched on, like the fact that biblical rights do not oversee human rights, or the fact that, you know, biblical rights do not go over biblical commands, right? So those kind of concepts really got me thinking this morning. So yeah, we can start with the questions and go from there.
I think we've already broached around your extensive experience traveling both here in the country to remote communities, but also internationally. It might seem trite or an easy question, but what was the compelling reason to go specifically to Gaza, which was and remains one of the most dangerous places to serve?
Yeah, so I had an experience that changed me very profoundly in 2015. So when I was living in Calgary in medical school, I was friends with a lot of Jewish classmates, and they spoke about Israel, and I never really thought that much about the country of Israel. So I was curious. After my fellowship, I decided to go visit Israel. And while I was there, I thought, well, maybe I should go check out the West Bank while I'm here. And then I had this kind of recurring thought, and I think probably God was prompting me to go on this tour. So I went to this tour that's happening in Hebron, right? So Hebron is the place where Abraham buried his wife. And Hebron is a very contentious place, and it has its own special agreement in the context of all the other agreements they have there in the West Bank. But to summarize quickly, what happened was that we went to the mosque, and that mosque was the place where Abraham buried his wife Sarah, underneath the mosque. And as we left the mosque, I saw that there was a Israeli border person who was angry at the checkpoint nearby. And I saw that one of my buddies in the tour was hiding. And so I decided to hide with him. And as I was hiding with that man, the Israeli border police shot and killed a 17-year-old girl who was coming home from school. And I didn't see the shooting because I was hiding, but I was, of course, quite scared. And afterwards, we went inside a woman's house, and that woman was supposed to be making us lunch, but she was not feeling very well. Her kids were running around the house. She was trying to keep her kids inside the house so they wouldn't get hurt. The tour leader was there. He was wringing his hands because he'd just seen a girl die. That helped me understand how it might feel in my body and my heart and mind to live under occupation, which is something that, you know, we don't experience in our life as Canadians. And that got me thinking about how it might be to live under occupation. And then I ended up learning more about Palestine and Israel and what's going on there. And then I started being interested in going to Gaza. So I was thinking of going to Gaza since 2016. And last year I decided to go on a silent prayer retreat, which is something I've never really been that interested in doing, a 30-day silent retreat before, but I had a strong feeling I should do that. And I did that in November. And while I was on the retreat, I was offered to go on this medical mission. And I was really deeply afraid of going there. And I was able, after praying and working through with my spiritual director, to have some new freedom to be able to accept that mission. And then I left at the end of January, and I left Gaza on February 27th. And I think what also inspired me was going to the Christ at the Checkpoint conference last year and learning about God's solidarity and how our solidarity needs to be lined up with God's solidarity. So those are some of the experiences that inspired me to make that decision to go.
My next question explored the idea of solidarity. I asked Dr. Lalonde to expand on the idea of what it looks like to side with who God claims solidarity with.
First of all, our solidarity needs to be lined up with God's solidarity. Secondly, another really important point that I learned from the conference was that solidarity is costly. Solidarity without cost is meaningless. And also that as activists, sometimes we're motivated by our anger. And I'm not anti-anger, but what I learned at the conference was the emphasis that we should be motivated by God's anger and not our own anger. When we look at the stories in the Bible and the way that Jesus behaved while he was here on earth, his solidarity was very much in line with the oppressed and with the marginalized. So regardless of our opinion about an issue or the type of people that we may feel closer to, for example, I'm a mixed race person, but I look very white, right? So when I go to Israel, people think I'm Israeli, people think I'm Jewish, everybody treats me like I'm their, you know, like I fit right in from their perspective. My solidarity is not about who I fit more in with, right? My solidarity needs to be in line with God's vision, right? God's redemptive vision for the world, right?
Yeah, I appreciate you naming some of those components of where our activism lies and how we can be shaped and formed to come alongside the existing justice that God has in mind. But part of the problem, I think, with this widespread carnage that we're seeing is this, like on news and in social media, is discerning through propaganda. Yet you have been in for a month, yes. I think. Can you tell us about where you served, your role, and the realities that you were seeing?
Yeah, so I worked as a physician in the emergency department of a hospital called the European Gaza Hospital. It's a big trauma center, so it would be like the foothills equivalent in Calgary. And we would receive traumas locally, but we would also receive trauma transfers from other hospitals because we had some specialties that other hospitals didn't have. Like we had neurosurgery, for example. So if people had blood in their brain found at other hospitals, they would be transferred to our institution for treatment. And that hospital, just to give you a good idea, is not that far from Rafah, so the Rafah border to Egypt that's been closed since last May. So at night, for example, we could hear the tanks that were near Rafah. We were, I think, about 5 kilometers away from Rafah. So if you go from the bottom of Gaza, the first neighborhood is Rafah. The second neighborhood is Khan Yunis. And the third neighborhood is Deir al-Bala, which is kind of in the middle of Gaza. So we were on the border of Rafah and Khan Yunis. At that time, we worked in the emergency room. So we saw all kinds of different patients. We saw people who were impacted by violence directly from the genocide. So people who were shot by snipers, people shot by quadcopters. So a quadcopter is like a small drone that can talk to people and also can drop grenades and also can shoot people. And we also see people who were affected by missiles. We saw people who were affected by violence related to the genocide, but that is not armed violence. Let's say kids who fell. We had a baby, for example, that fell 3 or 4 stories because they were living in an unsafe house. We have to understand more than 90% of housing units in Gaza are destroyed, right? So the vast majority of my colleagues when I was there were living in tents and had had their houses destroyed. And we saw people who had some hygiene-related issues, so either gastrointestinal diseases related to bad water or skin rashes that were related to that kind of thing. I was also a witness to the prisoner releases. So the Palestinian hostages or prisoners that were kept in Israel were released and came directly to our hospital. So we saw and treated those patients. And we also saw people who had untreated diseases, like let's say they had had high blood pressure for a number of years, untreated during the genocide, and now they had a bleed in their brain, or they had hepatitis, they had no access to their medication, and so they had decompensated, like they were in liver failure from that. And so those were the type of patients that we were seeing. And, you know, as you drive around Gaza, like as I was coming in, Gaza is very much has a post-apocalyptic feeling, right? So when you're driving around Gaza, it's like, it feels a little bit like that movie, I Am Legend, except that the housing units are not intact, but the people are there. Whereas I Am Legend is the opposite, right? There's just one person, but the city is largely physically intact. So there's a lot of that kind of destruction. And it looks like it does in the drone videos that we see on Instagram and other places.
One of the components there of sifting through storytelling is that eyewitnesses and yourself, for example, and those who journalists who are left and trying to share pictures of what is happening, a lot of it is explained away with ease. It's too easy because either they justify around, well, Hamas, blah, 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 or Hamas is in the hospitals. But was there a sense of you were in the space that you were in, pushed against or had troubles against the ongoing political realities that also, you know, includes the violent aspects?
Yeah, so I think we have to go back to like this concept of who is Hamas, right? So we have to think about the way that, in my opinion, the Israeli narrative has confounded what is Hamas and who is Hamas, right? So imagine Hamas was voted into power in 2006, right? So I personally do not remember who I voted for in 2015, for better or for worse. And Justin Trudeau came into power. But let's say I'd voted for Justin Trudeau in 2015. Does that mean that I am liberal? And then if the Liberal Party is a terrorist organization, that I should die? Or, for example, if I work at the Liberal office and I have a profession as a cook, and I cook at the Liberal office and I make them lunch in the basement of Parliament or something, does that mean that I deserve to die or that my children deserve to die? I think there's a big conflation. Like when the Israeli politicians use the word Hamas, they use the word Hamas. They don't talk about Al-Qassam, which is the military arm of Hamas, which also involves the resistance fighters, right? So there's a huge conflation there. And we have to understand that the population of Gaza is extremely young. For example, in my department, I thought about all my colleagues. I worked with a huge amount of ER colleagues. And there's only one who is old enough to even vote in the 2006 election. All of my colleagues are younger than me. So the population in Gaza is extremely young. Before this current genocide, 50% of the population were under 18. So you can just imagine that the vast majority of the population was not even able to vote in 2006. So how can we really say that they are Hamas, right? When it comes to what I saw, so I did not see any Al-Qassam resistance fighters in the hospital. There were some hostage releases while I was there, so I did see some in the street. They were headed towards the press conferences that you may have seen. One day we were driving to the hospital and we saw some in the street, but they're known to not frequent the hospital. There was no evidence that they had a military base at my hospital while I was there. In terms of the people that I did see, you know, I saw children who were affected by violence by the IDF, right? So I saw a 3-year-old who had an unexploded device that exploded in her face, and she had a burn on her face, and she suffered a lot. I saw a 13-year-old kid. You know, there's a lot of parentification of children going on in Gaza. And this little boy, I understand that his two parents were both sick or injured. And so he decided to risk everything to go to Rafah to go and get some food. And while he was there, he was targeted by a sniper, and he came to our emergency alone, and he was wandering around. I remember him so clearly because he was crying, and he was wandering around wearing a pink backpack, and he just looked so lost and devastated. And we were trying to get things organized so that he could have some good follow-up for his wound care because he'd been shot by a sniper. So those kind of situations really stay with me. I didn't see anyone who experienced violence from the resistance fighters, but I did see people who experienced violence from the Israeli Defense Forces. And I think it's also important when we think about a political movement like Hamas. So they are a political party, and they're, in a lot of ways, they're very similar to the Second Amendment American movement, right? Where they believe, for example, if you talk to a Second Amendment American, they might say something like, oh, if someone comes into my house, I have the right to defend myself, and they might own a gun, right? And there is some very similar ways of thinking when we look at the Hamas charter, right? So Hamas had a charter written in the 1980s and another one written in 2017. And we read through it together at that conference I went to last year with a Christian Palestinian scholar who says he's a theological scholar, but he studies the Holy Quran. So, you know, there's a lot of ways of thinking that the resistance fighters have in common with Second Amendment Americans. And, you know, when it comes to war crimes, I'm really happy to condemn all of the Al-Qassam war crimes that have been committed. But as a doctor and a Christian and a person of integrity, I must also condemn all the war crimes that have been committed by the Israelis as well.
Thank you for that. You alluded to this, and I'm not sure if there's a distinction between your hospital and children's hospitals there. And I know many of the hospitals have been, you know, bombed out of existence. But in terms of the devastation and the targeting of children and the loss of children in such a short amount of time, which is monumental, it's devastating. Does that line up to what you were seeing in the hospital and on the street?
Yes, absolutely. So I was there, but there's also an excellent article written by one of my friends, Dr. Feroz Sidwa. And the article is entitled 65 Nurses, Doctors, and Paramedics, What We Saw in Gaza. And basically, they interviewed these 65 healthcare professionals. And what they gathered was that 44 doctors, nurses, and paramedics saw multiple cases of preteen children who had been shot in the head or chest. So this is a widespread experience of healthcare professionals who volunteer in Gaza that we're seeing children who are targeted. And the children that I saw were mostly shot by snipers. So that means that the individual who shot them, looked through the sight of their gun and saw the person that they were shooting at. And the people that I saw who were shot in a way that showed that they posed no risk to the person who shot them. So I think of a young boy, I remember he came to our hospital with three friends. So I treated one of the friends and I transferred him to another hospital. And then I went to the ICU with this kid. He was the sickest of the three, so I went to the ICU to make sure he was okay. And I was there with him for a few hours on the first day because he wasn't feeling well. When he woke up, he told us the story of how him and his friends had been shot. And then I continued going to the ward and checking on him. And he showed me so much kindness and hospitality. And he was a really sweet kid. He told us that the best moment of his day was when he opened his eyes in the morning and he saw his mother's face. So we have to keep in mind, like, not only are children being targeted, but each of these children is a beautiful creature made in the image of God. It has a whole story and is the whole world to the people that love them. And then I think also there's it's important to also make some comments about the psychological distress that children are experiencing, right? So War Child did a study about the impacts of this current genocide on children, and this was done in December. So it said they interviewed more than 500 children, and they said 96% of children feel that death is imminent, and 49% wish to die because of the war. And that's reflected in my colleagues in the study that I'm quoting. There were 52 out of 65 people said that the children they met had psychiatric distress, were suicidal, or wanted to die. So the children are really bearing the psychological, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual impacts of this genocide.
I know you've commented on this a little bit, and it's changed since you've come back. Well, it hasn't changed, but there have been more instances of... So Israel would claim that... and by Israel, I don't mean Israelis. I mean with the current government that is in charge. They claim that routine aid is getting into Gaza. There's been enough, although that's been refuted by every organization. There's mass starvation happening. It's intentional to choke off aid. What did you see in terms of, and the stories, some of the most recent stories in terms of aid being delivered, and right now that is purely in the hands of the government, the IDF, Israel, and the U.S.?
So as people know, the aid right now is being managed by an organization that's entitled the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is a partnership between Israeli and Americans. And my boss, mentor, and the founder of the organization that I went to Gaza with, he did an interview on Al Jazeera yesterday where he talked about how he's seeing patients at the hospital that are being targeted in every way imaginable, the GHF site. So many have gunshots to the head and neck. Some are being hit by spread shots. So that means like machine gun open fire. There's been explosive injuries. So drones have been dropping like anti-personal grenades on people. There's been shelling and bombings. And the patients tell him, like, I had no choice but to go to this dangerous site because I'm starving and I need to feed my children. And this is reflected in the stories that I'm hearing from my friends. So I have a friend and in Gaza, and I'm friends with him and his wife, Mar and Sama. And he went to the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation site a few weeks ago. He went with his friend, and he left. He said, I went with my friend and I left with his body in a bag. So he posted a video on Instagram, and he said as part of the video, this is my best friend, Mohammed. We shared everything, laughter, love, hunger, fear. We survived the worst together until a bag of flour took him from me. Yes, just a bag of flour. That's what he was trying to get when they killed him with U.S. made weapons. It wasn't aid, it was a trap. We were surrounded from every corner, drones above, bullets from all sides. We were hunted like mice. I walked beside him through it all, but I came back alone. I survived barely, and survival has never felt this heavy. And then in the video, you'll see his funeral, his face, his name. Please just remember him. Remember Mohammed. He didn't die in vain. He was killed by a system that turned food into a weapon. Say his name, share his story, and don't let the world forget him. So my friend Maher is mourning his friend Mohammed. And these, and I receive texts all the time from people, you know, saying that their loved one went to the aid site and was either killed or injured. So right now, that's a big focus of advocacy for the organization that I went to with, and for many other organizations as well. You can imagine we would have, I hoped we would not have accepted, for example, during the Rwandan genocide, that we would hire the Hutus to be the ones giving out the aid to the moderate Hutus and the Tutsis that they were killing. And that's a big focus. While I was there, I observed that all the children had malnutrition and that the food in the market was not adequate for treating people with malnutrition. There was a little bit more food while I was there because I was there during the time that they named a ceasefire. I say that it was named a ceasefire because we saw a lot of war crimes every day at our hospital. There was a little bit more food at that time, but as you know, once malnutrition progresses, it's a complicated disease that requires a lot of different types of treatment. And right now there's been a lot of talk about baby formula. So what has not been in these aid boxes by this distributed at these sites is baby formula. And my pediatrician colleagues have been sharing with me that there's no baby formula for the kids at the hospital, for their own children, and that children are dying because of the baby formula.
At some point, we consider what it is we can do and what we specifically in Canada can do and where we can go from here. I know we're going to post a number of these in the Discord, but did you have any brief highlights before we go to Q&A here on specific calls to action for us?
Yeah, so I think a big demand that's really important to be making of our politicians right now is to close the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, so these food sites that are murdering people every day. That's a huge focus right now. Another focus is around advocacy around baby formula. Another focus is there's a petition about towards our government to name it, stop it, sanction it, meaning the genocide. So we need to call it a genocide, which has been clearly outlined by so many genocide scholars. And there's also been a big focus on contacting our officials and talking about the arms embargo piece of it, right? So, for example, this week, Francesca Albanese came out and said that, for example, I live in Quebec and our retirement funds that we put in, that the government invests for us, have been invested in a company that's involved in the genocide. And most of our banks are involved in this genocide as well. And we're also, there's no arms embargo at this point, right? There hasn't been a real arms embargo, despite all the statements made by Jolly and by Carney. And also, I think our professional associations need to be called out. This week, I was looking on the Collège des Médecins du Québec, so the Quebec Medical College website. So this is an organization that I pay fees to every year to regulate the doctors here in Quebec. And less than a month after Russia started bombing Ukraine, they made a big email about solidarity towards the Ukrainian people and have not spoken about solidarity towards the Palestinian people after, you know, more than 600 days of being ruthlessly killed, right? So there's a lot of, I think that it can be tempting to be hopeless, but as Canadians, we're very involved in this genocide, and that means that there are a lot of pressure points that we have and a lot of power that we have. And also as Christians, unfortunately, our institution of the church has also been very involved in the genocide. Without the money that comes from the church in North America, this genocide wouldn't be able to be properly executed. And also, unfortunately, like Rohadi was outlining at the beginning, the church has provided a lot of theological software for the genocide. which is of course itself an oxymoron, right? Because we cannot have an ology of genocide that involves Theo, right? That involves God, right? So that's like a huge oxymoron in of itself. And a lot of the end time theories that are being thrown around within that narrative are also very anti-Semitic. So we have a lot of, you know, when I think about myself, for example, I'm contributing to the genocide in so many different ways. And that means that I have so many different ways that I can act to no longer participate in that genocide.
Dr. Lalonde then ends our conversation with a question, which I think aptly closes this bonus episode. It's a question for you, to the listener, about making sense of your own response to this ongoing genocide.
How do you think that, like, when I think about the church, I think about, like, in the biblical view of the church, right, we're supposed to be the bride of Christ, right? So when you love someone, you would challenge them, right? So how do you think that we can call out the church? Yeah. And something I think about is, like, we often talk about the oneness of the church. I go to an Anglican church where there are many people from different denominations. My pastor spoke about the oneness of the church a month ago. And the oneness of the church is really beautiful when I think, oh, Rohatty is in Calgary doing something amazing. But then when I think, well, Nikki Haley is signing bombs that are being used to kill Palestinian children, I feel less good about the oneness of the church. The oneness of the church cuts both ways. So how can we address that?